who over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Bressel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 542, and it's April the 25th, 1982. I saw a picture in the newspaper this week of the comedian, the Taxi star Andy Kaufman, being held upside down by the wrestler that took him seriously and decided to pounce his head on the floor and call it, it's called the pile driver. They have his head between the boxer's, the wrestler's legs, and his feet are in the air, and he's ready to bang his head on the floor, and he had a severe spinal injury from it. And when Kaufman woke up from this injury, he said that he thought that they were just kidding around, that the wrestler was just hamming it up for the crowd, but he thought it was show business until he ended up with a severe spinal injury. When I saw that, I thought of the mountains of articles I have that come out every week, the important things that are in the news, and how the average American person is really playing pile driver. I think that the administration and the people in power since World War I, and certainly the period that I've studied extensively since World War II, just about have our head down between their legs, our feet in the air, and they're ready to bang our heads. And it reminded me of the situation as it is, the way that we're being turned in every aspect of our society into something that we really shouldn't become, and the injuries are going to follow later, and the inability of people to do anything but to think that it's only a game and to have so many diversions away from what's really taking place. I'm going to do a little bit about Antarctica and Argentina tonight. I have many articles that are pertinent to it, but I want to spend more time on some side effects of what's going on. In the last 2 weeks, I've discussed what would be happening and how it would come about and why, and there seems to be a shooting war this morning. They're not going to back down as of the time I came to this radio station, and I don't believe that our government is set up in any way to do anything but to favor the Argentinians. On the surface, we will look like we're appeasing the British or going along with them, and our loyalties, according to Senator Jackson and other people in the news media that you hear or read about, they verbally give their loyalties to the British, but underneath the money, the energy, the planning, the investments all are down in South America and Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Central America, and this is the area that our government has been pushing their energy in the last years. Part of this has to do with importing this large amount of Nazis to this country and to South America and combining their forces for the events that are just taking place right now. One of the dirtiest articles or series to come out of this so far, and there will be plenty, as there are continuously, is again the agent provocateur Jack Anderson playing a certain role. 50% of what Jack writes is good, and then because it's good and it's interesting and timely, he can come in with other things that are very insidious. And a perfect example was this week the Jack Anderson column that made the front page of the Washington Post, that was Saturday, April the 17th, of the telephone conversation between Alexander Haig and Ronald Reagan. And it's exactly like the Deep Throat episode that took place 10 years ago to get Richard Nixon out of office. Keep in mind that Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan are fronts for both the CIA, the Defense Department, and organized crime, but the intelligence apparatus wants to get its muscles and tentacles totally into the White House, and with Vice President Bush, former director of the CIA, there is just one moment's throw away from having Bush as director. And so it's time to make fun of Ronald Reagan. That isn't very hard to do, but it's time to come in and undermine him as they did Richard Nixon. And the Washington Post did it with their Woodward and Bernstein hitting the areas where they get Nixon out of office but cover up all the other things and the continuous murders related to Watergate. So that Jack Anderson had a column this week where there's an April 9th telephone conversation in the Falkland Islands. It was about the Falkland Islands between Alexander Haig, who is airborne, and Ronald Reagan, who was in the Barbados. Reagan describes how he's swimming around and he has messages for Haig. But the important thing is that the front page of the Washington Post, the April 17th article, and the other excerpts from other newspaper articles referring to Jack Anderson say that this telephone conversation was intercepted, that it was a 3.5-minute conversation between these two parties, that it was directed and given to Jack Anderson, that he checked with the Secret Service, and it was authentic, and then he went ahead and printed it, and the Secret Service is totally aware of it. The only problem with that was that everything Ronald Reagan said is printed, and everything Alexander Haig said is not printed. So that, again, Haig is always protected as if he's some special kind of a god, and he did work along with these Watergaters to get himself to be chief of staff at the height of Watergate when Richard Nixon was being taped, and Mr. Alex Butterfield, Haig's buddy, was there taping him and getting the president of the United States out of office. The excuse for not having Haig on the tape was that the Haig's responses are inaudible because of interference of static. Now, I don't know much about radio or electronics, but it seems really strange that two people can have a telephone conversation and only one voice is recorded and one is wiped out. So Ronald Reagan is saying, "Hello, Al, I'm glad the British fleet doesn't move very fast," because Al is on the way down to Argentina. He says, "You must have been in the air for 12 hours. Then he giggles. He says, "There's going to be an uphill struggle," meaning when you get to Argentina. "Did you get any idea as to whether the emotion that you met in your meetings goes beyond the parliament to the people as well?" Asking British supporting Margaret Thatcher, in addition to the business meetings, what are the people doing? And then Haig, there's a 10-second pause. Then Reagan, "It sounded as if there was not much acceptance of the multinational presence here. Are there any variants of what you think she might go for?" And then there's a Haig 13-second pause. Then Reagan says, "Incidentally, that submarine of theirs, do you think it's apt to go ahead with retribution and sink anything? Or would that be enough to vindicate them?" And then there's a pause again. And he says, "I don't ask you to speculate on the next steps. You haven't been to Buenos Aires. But in those talks, if it's helpful at all, why don't you go back on making me the bad guy and insisting on restraint if that's necessary?" So whatever they're manipulating, he says, "Go on, you can go back, make me the bad guy," because Reagan knows that he can laugh and hand out the jelly beans and be real cutesy at his press conferences and giggle and wave his hand as he gets in and out of a helicopter and have no answers that are intelligent on this thing at all. So he wants, Haig can do what he wants, and Reagan will be made out the bad guy. Then there's a 19-second pause, and he says, "Well, it's a tough uphill fight. Just let us know if there's anything at this end that we can do and be of help." And then there's another 8-second response. He said, "Had a good swim in this ocean that you're looking down on." Haig's up in the air flying over. "Oh, it was wonderful." He says, "I'll make it over and out then, unless you've got something else." Well, this is such a trite conversation, but the point is that Reagan's saying, as the President of the United States, "Well, if I have to take the brunt, go ahead and let me. You keep looking big guy." And the interesting thing, if they're going to print it at all, to get a telephone conversation that's tapped, that's delivered to the mouthpiece of the world, that's Jack Anderson, why not have a true account of what Haig said? Whatever it was Haig said, somebody protects him and burps it out. And they also talked about a skirmish, a possible skirmish. And Reagan said in the conversation, "The British will want a skirmish to save face." And Secretary of Haig reported, "The Argentinians are a little more flexible than the British." And that one sentence was in there, allegedly from Haig, that the rest was blocked out. So if they could hear Al on one second, they could hear the other. But Reagan, the friend of Great Britain, of Margaret Thatcher, I mean, really a rotten fellow, he's saying, "Well, the British want a little skirmish to save face," and without any understanding of just exactly what is going on. But the mentors of Haig and these various parties, one is the Council of Foreign Relations, published a book in 1975, which I just recently got, and it's about a directory of foreign nations and the city's geography, the news media, and facts about the major countries from the United Nations. And in there, it lists Argentina, and it's the second largest country in South America. Argentina owns the Falkland Islands. Now, I thought that was pretty interesting. This came out in 1975, and for all purposes, the Falklands belonged to British up to this month when Argentina went in. They may have psychologically or emotionally felt that it belonged to them down there off of Argentina. But the Council of Foreign Relations hired two professors from upstate New York to write this large book, a very big book, on various countries, and they said Falklands belonged to Argentina. So the Council of Foreign Relations with David Rockefeller, and Nelson was alive at that time, and with Haig as their protege, and Henry Kissinger, put into their history books the Falklands was Argentine to begin with. So in the tapes, they say, well, Margaret wants a little skirmish to save face, and so forth. They've already decided what they're going to do. It'll be interesting to see how they worm their way in and out. The most interesting article on Antarctica was the one from the Sunday Times, New York Times, March the 14th, 1982. It's about 3,000 inhabitants that live down there that live and work at 36 permanent stations. That book on Antarctica, also on various countries, listed Antarctica as being a country not inhabited by any person in 1975, and that's an outright lie. So you can see how the best minds of the country, if you read the directory of who's who from the Council of Foreign Relations, from the news media and the public offices and the private attorneys and government officials, their official book for geography and countries mentions that Argentina is not inhabited. The New York Times says that there's 36 permanent stations and 3,000 inhabitants in Antarctica, not Argentina, in Antarctica. And the important thing about this one article that hinges on a lot of things that I've mentioned on these broadcasts before is that it deals with the law down in Antarctica. Now, there have been several other articles and mentioned on the news media today, just today, about the relationship of Argentina to the Falklands to Antarctica. And right next to those islands is Antarctica. And this article says, in international law, Antarctica is a twilight zone. And it refers to a professor, Richard B. Bilder, a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin, who made some statements working for the State Department's legal office that Antarctica is the place to murder your mother-in-law because nobody would have jurisdiction over there and know what to do about the problem. What is the best place if you want to eliminate somebody and get away with it? The answer is an American station in Antarctica. What would happen if an American killed a Russian in the Australian sector? He brings up the legal questions. If Japan killed somebody over a Chilean claim down there, and this article is about the laws of life down in Antarctica that have to be studied now, and it said it goes beyond the mineral and the oil, the energy resources of Antarctica. And this is the interesting thing, because we've been hearing a lot about the oil and the minerals down in that area. The problem of law in Antarctica goes beyond it. There are 3,000 scientists working down there and military people now from 12 nations, 36 permanent stations. It is a continent as large as the United States and Mexico combined. And then the article goes on to say the resolution of the legal situation is important, not only for settling potential conflicts among themselves, but also because it may provide a model for the coming age of space colonization when large numbers of human beings might live for extended periods aboard spacecrafts or the moon. Now that's the catch, and the point that I've been concerned about is that this large mass of both Antarctica and particularly the Falkland Islands, once those few hundred people are removed from there, the British people, if they leave and don't want to be there with the Spanish or the Argentinians that are already there, I say Spanish because many Nazis went down to Argentina from World War II, and many weren't back and forth from Argentina to the continent of Europe. Now, this is a large mass the size of the United States plus Mexico, and they suggested it may be a model for the coming age of space colonization when large numbers of human beings may live for extended periods down in Antarctica. Now, one of the things that I worried about 10 years ago tonight exactly was the use of these large airports, particularly the Dallas-Fort Worth airport that had just been built for the migration, for moving large amount of people to remove them from this country. That's before I knew about the book Alternative 3 and the plans for space stations and removing about 80% of the population of the United States because of pollution and not having to share the resources and getting them to space stations or out of sight. 10 years ago, April 25th, 1974, I had an article in the Berkeley Bar, titled, Is S.L.A. Sin Q, that's Donald DeFries, the first black Lee Harvey Oswald. And this book was about racism, about domestic problems, about the plans to exterminate a lot of people and to use the examples such as S.L.A. kidnapping or terrorism to get the SWAT teams ready for locating people and mass migration later. On the cover of the Berkeley Barb, I said, in the past 10 years, we have seen the murder of a president, a senator, congressman, civil rights leaders, and hundreds of other victims that are related conspiracies. The next 10 years will be bloody and fearful for the minorities in the United States. Now, it's exactly 10 years since that date, but there was a little time from 1974 until the end of the Carter administration when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was investigating murders, when the Senator Church Committee was investigating the illegal CIA, the Rockefeller Committee, the House Committee under Representative Pike. We had a stalemate there before Ronald Reagan became president. He was governor of California when I wrote this, and these people went on and moved to Washington. But I asked the question, where would we be 10 years from now? But you could push it up 4 years because there was 4 to 6 year grace with Jimmy Carter in there and the 2 years of investigation after Richard Nixon was out of office. I said the defense intelligence agencies will continue the policies of Nazis and genocide can be made possible. Two large airports will be utilized to move large masses of people. At that time, they were planning a huge airport at San Diego, which was scrapped after the Watergate stories broke. They planned, I wrote about, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, close to the Mexican border, the airports they had designed with extra thick runways to accommodate the giant 747 planes. The planes themselves, which have proved impractical for civilian airline use, were purchased by the military and at that time were remodeled for mass transport. Their engines are turned over every day at a cost of thousands of dollars so that they can be pressed into notice at a day's notice. And I wrote about the 12.5 million acres of California desert land stretching from the Mexican border in San Diego to the Sierra Nevada. And I've been reading in the newspaper this past week that the anti-Castro Cubans are training in the California deserts for the revolution in this country and for to defend fascism against socialism or whatever they think should be done. There are groups in this country of anti-Castro Cubans, Minutemen, and Nazis training, particularly in that desert area that I was writing about that was closed off. And I also mentioned that new $105 million hospital at Travis Air Force Base on 82 private acres, totally inaccessible to most persons, where there'll be a computerized hospital room designed to include a revolutionary one-room treatment center, according to Colonel Oliver Hood, who admitted that it was too radical at the time to explain what it was for. And I asked, what would that prison hospital would be used for? How could it be used? And 10 years ago, I was saying that Congress is purposely hurting our economy. They are losing the chance for good housing, for jobs, or education for minority. They're impounding funds, cutting off school busing, denying legal aid to the poor. And that's in the news this week. That's a big issue about a fascist bigot that Reagan has appointed to eliminate the bureau that takes care of legal aid for the poor. All steps toward equal opportunity and racial progress are being halted. Now, that's just a fraction of the article. It's a long article. And 10 years ago, I was talking about the use of these massive airports for control. Another part of that New York Times article, before I get back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the New York Times article on the possibility of preparing people in these large masses for moon and for space colony you're not living up there, you're not working up there. I guess it's, what would you call your trip to Auschwitz? I think it's just called genocide to get rid of large masses of people. It can't possibly be constructive or beautiful like Gerard O'Neill designs it at Princeton University with those floating clouds and trees. It's a place for extermination. In this New York Times article that talks about the possibility of using this large landmass down in Antarctica for getting ready to prepare for moon living or space colonies, there's a large territorial claim map that was printed in the New York Times, and it shows how Antarctica is divided. And there's a section that is unclaimed, and there's New Zealand's claim in Australia, and the McMurdo Station the United States uses, and then France's little claim, and Australia has a big piece. And then there's a hunk of that pie on the right side of Antarctica that's called Norway. And it's in that section, in the middle of that section called Norway, that Admiral Byrd saw the warm water, brown hills, green grass colony, that the issue of the Police Gazette has drawings, the one published in 1977, where they allege that Adolf Hitler was taken to that area, marked Norway. And then above that, there's a hunk marked off on that pie in the north east corner called Argentina, that section that belongs to Argentina. And that's the area that Adolf Hitler has designated on the, it's given his name and says it's designated as the area that he surfaced and put the Nazi flags on down in 1939 when he was looking for a place in case he couldn't accomplish what he wanted. He'd have an alternate going there. So there's a section of Antarctica for Chile. There's a part for the United States. New Zealand, the McMurdo Station, as I say, is in that one little corner on the west side. But the Norway section is where the warm water bases where Admiral Byrd would have been for his, he was for his first trip in 1946-47 that I mentioned that is on the programs before. And then the Argentine section is marked off, and that's where Adolf Hitler on the map of Antarctica secured his own area for himself. Now, the Police Gazette, the volume that I have, it's 50 pages, and I really must get it reprinted for those of you who want to copy it and get it to you, discusses here how the ships went from Norway when the war was just about over. There was a U-boat 530 which proceeded. It was to supposed to help with the escape of Hitler. The U-977 in April 1945 was sent to Norway. The superiors were ordered to go to Norway, and Admiral Dönitz, Hitler's chief of the Navy, who was to take over when he was there no longer, provided the information to go to Norway. This is mentioned in the books. And then on the escape route of Hitler, and then the other page, it says, on the other hand, the U-977 left Norway May the 2nd and arrived July the 8th in the vicinity of Cape Verde Island. Why did it take 2.5 months to get up to Argentina? And the allegations are here that it went from Argentina down to the bases that Hitler had built. And then there was that Norway base that is, if Norway has this big hunk of Antarctica, it is the exact place where Admiral Byrd was in the warm water bases when he said, we have not entered World War II and we'll have to have a defense system down there. Now, in terms of those airlines that could take people down and large amounts of people moved on those 747s, which I saw, could see this happening 10 years ago, the way the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport was designed, these huge planes and so forth. There's an article regarding the American Airlines this week. You know, they are trying to take over and have been accused of getting Braniff Airlines out of business by using the computer system and breaking them, pulling out the regular Watergate bag of dirty tricks. And the newspapers this week, one, the Oakland Tribune, says, Dirty Tricks Grand Jury, Fort Worth, Texas. A federal grand jury is investigating the dirty tricks, alleged dirty tricks by American Airlines against nearly bankrupt Braniff International. They're claiming that there's a bitter feud between Braniff and American, rivals for control of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, American tried to crash Braniff Airline to make it bankrupt so that Pan American could take over all the South American routes. If you've been listening every week, you'll follow what I'm saying. If you haven't, let me see if I can simplify that in a moment. There's a conflict between Pan American Airline that is also broke but wants to buy Braniff Airlines. American helped Braniff get broke by playing dirty tricks on it. And by its losing money, Pan Am could take the entire South American route of Argentina and Chile and Peru and Colombia and every country except Venezuela. They'd have total control of everyone who goes in and out of the country. And by America helping Braniff get bankrupt, America would control, American Airlines, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So what we have in the news this week
in the week that preceded it was the attempt to control all the routes of South America and the attempt to control the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And those were the two areas that 10 years ago I was concerned about and writing about. Another article in the Los Angeles Times says, Americans, that's American airline tactics in brand of battle being probed. And it again refers to the fact that they want to weaken the allegations. They want to weaken the brand of airlines to monopolize the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And that if you monopolize that airport and then the other airline has a monopoly of who goes down to South America, you are really in trouble. Now, getting back to South America and monopoly of airlines, I mentioned last week that Pan Am was referred to in the book Children of Jonestown, that they were the ones that allowed the children to be sent in batches of 10 and 20 and 40 drugged with their hands tied behind their backs. And I want to continue those lines, another section of the book Children of Jonestown, because it has to do with the identification of dead bodies and the intent. Now I'm switching from the mechanics of getting people down to Antarctica to eliminate them through these airlines, commercial airlines, through the control of these airports, and through the airplanes are built. Now, what do you do with these people? What is the intent of the administration of the United States with American citizens? Let's start with Americans. Forget everyone else. In the book, The Children of Jonestown, on page 196, this is written by Kenneth Wooden in 1981. Initially, the United States and Guyana agreed the 400 bodies would be buried in Jonestown, but the body count rose day by day. That's another issue. But it goes on with the dead Americans, they were to be removed from Jonestown. The United States military was quickly mobilized, and within several days of Dr. Mutu's arrival and at the scene to start the grim task of removing the bodies, their first chore was to bayonet the bloated bodies to release internal gases caused by hot sun and humidity. They were kept 4 days so you couldn't tell if they're black or white or male or female. Their bodies were deteriorated and rotten. Okay. The second task they had was more controversial. Although Ordell Rhodes and Stanley Clayton, members of Jonestown, returned to the compound the very first morning and wanted to help identify who the dead were, on orders from very high up, all politically sensitive papers and forms of identification were removed from the corpses. Methods of identification were removed from the corpses. Photos on the cover of Newsweek and other magazines and newspapers clearly show many of the bodies had ID tags on them. Joel Cobb and John Stone, who are now among the unidentified children, were initially positively identified. Jim Cobb told NBC News in March 79, my brother Johnny saw tags on people's bodies, but only two members of my family were identified, and I want to know why. Lieutenant General Gordon Summer reported, it was the first time in his military career that he saw his men politicized in the U.S. Army in view of the fact that there was an order to strip the IDs that came from Robert Pastor on the staff of the big new Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor. And it is clear the impulse was to save any possible embarrassment to the Carter administration. This action would go ahead, and they made progress. They took off the identifications, and only six bodies, or seven rather, later had autopsies. Now, instead of running through a whole pile of articles I have here, maybe we should ponder what it means when Jimmy Carter's administration asked that we don't know who was down there and who was dead, stripped the identities, and a man who was third in the CIA is going to replace Bobby Inman as a deputy director of the CIA. He was in charge of counter operations, counterintelligence, and the Jonestown. And now he's working up to be deputy director of the CIA. I'll take a one-minute break, and we'll go on to some more on mass movement of people and not knowing who they are. Why can't we know, and how many people are going to be sent down to Falklands or Antarctica? Is it going to go into the millions?